Again to badquaker.com podcast. This is podcast number 119 for Tuesday, March 13th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and I wanted to cover a couple things today before I get into the main topic. I saw a debate. No, I didn't see that. That was an MP3. I heard a debate the other day between Doug Casey and the guy who's the head of the Ayn Rand Foundation or whatever that is. And I've heard him several times before, and I've noticed the inconsistency in the guy. And, you know, and I don't want to just pick on him and beat him up or anything like that. That's not the purpose of why I'm bringing this up. But I thought Doug Casey did a really good job. He's a pretty solid guy, and he's well informed, and he knows the whole process there. But the guy from the Ayn Rand organization said something that just struck me so odd that I thought, you know, how do these people even consider themselves libertarian when they say things like this? He said something to the effect of the debate in general was basically the minarchist-anarchist argument. And the Ayn Rand, I'm sorry I didn't look up his name, but I almost put up a mental block so that I don't remember their names. So the debate was between minarchism and anarchism, and Doug was making his case, and the other gentleman says, well, it's the same old thing like we always hear. If we didn't have the police, then we just have chaos and violence, and people would be doing this and doing that. And Doug basically said, well, you know, if everybody had full property rights to where anybody who wanted to be could be armed. Doug said, I find that an armed society is a polite society. And this guy, you could just hear in his voice the level of stress and fear as he was practically panicking at the thought of, of people being armed. And he just expressed, almost an illogical level of, it was an illogical level of fear of and mistrust of allowing people to be armed and just having anybody who wanted to be to be able to carry a weapon. That would be so horrible. How could we have this? And these people claim to be libertarians when they say this kind of nonsense. Now, first off, how is it that you can call yourself a libertarian and then you can decide that some type of property is acceptable for ownership, while other kinds of property, you know, the ones that you pick, are not acceptable for ownership? How is it that you call yourself a libertarian when you just arbitrarily draw a line across what is and what isn't property, and you say, well, this can be tolerated, but that can't? And why can't that? Because I don't like that. Because I don't trust you to have that. And it doesn't matter what the property is. It could be guns. It could be drugs. It could be bubblegum wrappers. It's not the point. Who owns it? This all falls back to the basic libertarian concept of ownership and of property rights. Who owns it? Do I own this object? Doesn't matter what the object is. Do I own it? Then how can you tell me what to do with it? If it's mine, if my sweat and my effort and my labor went to produce whatever units that I use to barter or trade with, so that I came up with this object, so that I traded for it honestly with no violence, with no aggression. How can you tell me what I can and can't do with it? And how is that libertarian, even in the most remote form? How can we possibly consider someone who says, I don't want an armed populace, how can that person be considered a libertarian? And yet they do. And I know we're not supposed to. We're not supposed to. I've gotten onto Walter Block about this, because Walter Block says, if you're not supporting Ron Paul, you're not a libertarian. Oh, really? So Walter Block gets to decide who's the libertarians now, right? Well, I'm putting myself in that position. Except here's the thing of it. If we look at what the definition of what a libertarian is, nowhere in the definition of what is a libertarian does it say you must support Ron Paul, but it does say you must support property rights. That's kind of basic to the concept. The non-aggression principle and the acceptance of property rights is the very foundation of what libertarianism is. Without those two things, if we're having a conversation about libertarianism, well, no, let's go in a different direction. Let's say we're talking about, building a house out of bricks. If we're having a conversation about building a house out of bricks, and the first thing you say is, now what we got to do is make sure there are no bricks involved in this building this house out of bricks. Well, then we're not really talking about building a house out of bricks, are we? If we're going to have a house built out of bricks, the one thing we need in the house is bricks. So with libertarian thought, if you don't have the two foundational aspects that are unique to libertarianism, the zero aggression principle and property rights, you don't have libertarianism. It doesn't matter what you label yourself or how many books you sell or how many lecture tours that you go on, or how many cult members you surround yourself with. If you don't have the zero aggression principle and property rights, you are not a libertarian. And that's not my standard. That's the standard of libertarians worldwide, and has been. And whoever holds to that, now, there are none of us are perfect. Not one of us is perfect. We're all humans. We all make mistakes. And none of our philosophies are exactly perfect, and none of us live exactly by perfect philosophies. But that's what we long for. That's what we seek to achieve, the zero aggression principle and property rights. So then if we just throw out property rights and we adopt this idea that, well, only some people can have guns and only some people can, well, all right, then you've just, thank you for being honest. You have just accepted the state. You have just decided that there are some people that are more special, that have greater levels of rights than other people. Now let's just think about this for a second. Before we go into that, let me treat this in a different direction. This inconsistency, when you see it in libertarians, it's very disturbing. And it's, to me anyway, it's a little bit more upsetting. I expect inconsistency with people on the right and people on the left. I mean, it's kind of the hallmark of the statist is inconsistency. But when a person starts to wrap themselves in the mantle of libertarianism, and they start to use the terminology and they start to claim to be libertarian, the main aspect of being a libertarian is the fact that we have a consistent philosophy, and those on the left and those on the right do not. I would challenge anybody on the left or on the right to lay out a consistent philosophy of what it is you believe. And then, let's just pick this apart and see if you really believe it. So then, if I say that I believe in the zero aggression principle, and I believe that nobody has the right to aggress on another person, to initiate aggression on another person, and then I walk down the street and just randomly punch somebody in the face, or if I want to hire somebody to randomly go down the street and rob people so that they can provide me chewing gum money, see, then I'm not a consistent libertarian, am I? I'm not consistent with my emphasis on the zero aggression principle. So then if you don't have the zero aggression principle, and if you don't have an understanding of property rights, what is it that makes you a libertarian? Just because you want to be a part of the cool club? Is that it? You maybe you like the symbology. Maybe you think it's cool. You don't want to be associated with the Democrats or the Republicans. So you think it's popular right now to be called a libertarian. But if that's the case, and you don't believe the two foundational principles of libertarianism, the zero aggression principle and natural property rights, you don't believe those two things, both of them, then why is it you call yourself a libertarian? Why are we having this conversation? Of course you're a minarchist. You're not just a minarchist. You're a full-blown statist. You don't want a minimum state if you grasp and hold to the concept that there are some people in society who can be trusted and the rest of us can't be trusted. So we have to give this authority to arm themselves to have special rights and take away those same rights from everybody else. If you believe that, you're not a libertarian. Just admit to the fact that you're a statist. And once you begin down that path, follow it consistently. Come to grips with it. Don't pretend you're on this path when you're actually on that path. There's an old book called Pilgrim's Progress. And there's a scene in it where the person is going along down the path. Pilgrim's Progress is an old Christian book. And the person is going on the path, on the Christianity path, so to speak. And what he doesn't realize is he's gotten himself into a rut on the path. And the rut actually leads off the path and on a different direction. And if he doesn't do something to get out of that rut, within a little while, he's not on the path at all. He's on a completely different path. And that's what happens if you're not consistent with the zero aggression principle and property rights. You may say that you're on the right path. You may use all the right terminology, but you're simply not. You're a statist. Come to grips with it, admit it to yourself, and then follow through on your philosophy. Because if there are some people in society who can be trusted with the ability to aggress upon others, and then the rest of us cannot be trusted with the ability to aggress upon others, then there are logical outcomes of that. And if you embrace half of libertarianism, but you don't embrace the zero aggression principle, then you're going to look really foolish when you try to defend yourself in an argument, as this guy did against Doug Casey in the debate that I'm talking about. I suppose that's probably why you didn't see Rand doing a lot of debating. I can imagine seeing Rand going up against somebody like Gary North or, Stefan Molyneux. By the way, speaking of Stefan Molyneux, I'm going to call him out here. I think Stefan's a great guy. I've never met him personally. I've listened to a lot of his stuff, and I know he's very popular. I don't know if we have any crossover audience between Bad Quaker podcast and Stefan Molyneux stuff. And I don't know if anybody who is close to Stefan or knows him or whatever is within my listener base. But two different times in conversations on Facebook, Stefan has said that he would, in his words, he would love to come on BadQuaker.com podcast. And both times I extended that invitation to him and asked him for details so that we can arrange the arrangements. And both times I didn't get an answer. So if you're close to Stefan, or if you know Stefan, or if we're part of the crossover audience between the two, between Bad Quaker and Free Domain Radio, maybe nudge him a little bit and say, hey, I'd like to hear you over there. If you would, if you would like to hear us, because I'd love to talk to Stefan and interview him. I worried at one point if he thought maybe I was trying to bait him over onto my podcast so that I could attack him on theology. And I would never do that to Stefan. I wouldn't do that to anybody, really. I respect Stefan's atheism just as much as if I was speaking to a Catholic or a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness or a Baptist or, a Buddhist or a Hindu or any other atheist. I would, I would respect Stefan's atheism 100% when I was speaking to him. You know, that my son-in-law, who just recently passed away, John, was on the show with Kai and I several times. And John was an atheist, and I got along wonderful with John. He and I had a lot of discussions on the topic, and there was never any pressure in one direction or the other. And I certainly didn't try to bait him or set him up or convince him of anything. So, you know, if just in this is, I guess this is my little commercial. If there is anyone that's a part of a crossover between Free Domain Radio and BadQuaker.com, if you have any kind of close connection to Stefan, encourage him to get back with me, because I'd love to have him on the program. Just he and I are so close on so many things, and the few things that we don't believe the same on are so minuscule. I mean, it's like maybe, you know, like 1% or less of our entire thing that we believe that would be in opposition. So there would be really no reason to clash over that 1%. But I would like to pick his brain a little bit on some of the things that he has a greater specialty on that I'm weaker on. I would love to be able to pick his brain on that. Not to, you know, not to try to embarrass him or anything, but just to get some information out of him. Anyway, back to my rant here. Let's see now. Let me try to get back to my notes. Okay, now back on the topic of gun ownership, and it really is down to what it really boils down to is property rights. If I don't have the right to own some kinds of property, then the entire libertarian argument begins to crumble and fall apart. If you believe the idea that some property is so different, so special, that not everyone can be allowed to possess that, not everyone can be allowed to own that, then it is so inconsistent with libertarian thought that if you try to express yourself, you're really going to fall into some traps and really going to look silly, because the inconsistency is so bold. Without the libertarian concept of property ownership, and without the libertarian concept of the zero aggression principle, your entire philosophy begins to wander back and forth, and you will ultimately end up in either the left or right camp, because that's probably philosophically where you belonged anyway. And once again, it is the inconsistency. I think I said it a second ago, is the actual hallmark of the statist. They want, people on the right, typically the conservative will tell you that, and I've said this before on podcasts, they'll tell you that, oh, well, if the student body of the certain college would have been armed, then so-and-so, this lone shooter, wouldn't have been able to walk around the college just indiscriminately shooting who he wanted to shoot, because, you know, somebody would take him out, a gun owner would take him out. And then that same conservative or that same right-wing person will tell you that we can't have a completely free citizenry. We can't have a completely free citizenry without the police state upon us, because people would just go around robbing and killing, and it would just be terrible. Wait a minute now. So what you're saying is, if all the students on a college campus were able to arm themselves, and some of those students actually did arm themselves, then when a lone gunman came on the campus, somebody would stop him. They wouldn't just sit around and hide under tables and wait for the police to come and save them, right? Is that that's the conservative argument that I hear? That's what they say on the gun forums, and that's what they say on the right-wing chat on the internet and on radio, that this would be a solution to the random shooter, the random lone wacko shooter, would be that if just a certain percentage of the population were armed, then they would fix that kind of thing. And yet, you don't apply that to the rest of society. So it would magically only work in schools, or maybe in schools and in McDonald's and maybe in churches, but it wouldn't work everywhere else in society. You mean a general arming of the population and a general free citizenry wouldn't provide a politer society? Is that what you're saying? It only works on the college campuses? It only works, you know, I've been to shooting ranges lots of times. Or, you know, hunting is another good example. When I was a child in the San Joaquin Valley, my dad and my brother, with all of their friends, went shooting pretty regularly. They would go out hunting in the cotton fields during pheasant season. And you would have one big cotton field. Now, this was way back in like the mid-60s. You would have a big cotton field there, and you would have maybe 40, 50 guys would be lined up at the end of this cotton field. And of those, very few knew each other. This was a sort of an understood ritual that would go on and when pheasant season would start in the San Joaquin Valley. So you'd have all these guys out there, and about the time the sun would come up, they would all get at the end of the field, and they would space themselves out voluntarily. And about the time the sun came up, they would all start walking down through the cotton field. And as the pheasants flew, people paid attention to the shooting patterns and where the pheasant flew up at and who was directly in front of the pheasant and all these things. And they shot the pheasants and they sorted out who shot what pheasant. And they were all armed and they didn't fight and they didn't kill each other over the pheasants. And why is it? Why is it that all these armed people didn't just fall on each other and start savagely shooting at each other? And the reason why is because armed people are polite people. Just like Doug Casey said, armed people are polite people. And there's another thing, too. There's a certain level of confidence. When a person obtains a certain level of confidence. Now, I'm saying this, I'm not, you know, a giant-sized guy. I'm about 6 foot. I'm the kind of a person who I'm bigger than the average person. But I'm not so big that I stand out in a crowd. I'm just slightly bigger than the average person. So this is all of my life. I've been like all the way through school. I was typically either the biggest kid in class or close to the biggest kid in class. And so I always had a certain level of confidence in my physical abilities. And this allowed me to be peaceful. I didn't need to be overly aggressive because I knew that I could handle, you know, whatever came up. And I also knew my own strength. And I also, as I became a young man, I understood my abilities and I understood that I could seriously hurt somebody if the situation arose. So for that reason, I was very careful. I was very, even when I got into, you know, I've talked before about some of my employment situations where physical aggression was part of the employment. But even then, I always knew that I had the ability to cause a lot of harm, and I always put restrictions on that, even when I was using enforcement tactics in the drug business and so forth. And that comes from a level of confidence. Now, you have this same level of confidence in an armed society. If you go to a gun range and there are a lot of people there and they don't necessarily like each other and yet they're all very polite. They're almost crazy polite at every gun range I've ever been to. And the same thing goes with your typical gun show. You can go to a gun show and the people are extremely polite at a gun show. And yet there are guns and ammunition and knives and all these weird weapons like swords and, you know, maces and all kinds of things around, and people are very nice. And the reason why is just like Doug Casey said, because an armed society is a polite society. And what works on the college campus and what works at the gun range and what works in the cotton field full of pheasant hunters would work when you're walking around in the mall or when you're on your job. Where you're in any kind of professional setting, it would work when you're at the bank. It would work pretty much anywhere where humans gather. That if it was known that many of the people there are openly armed and many of them are armed but not openly, If this were a knowledge that was general among everybody, then you would have a far more polite society and you would have far less need for dispute resolution, which is really what the original idea of having police was about. Of course, we're beyond that now. But when we think about, now I had mentioned that the inconsistency, and I mentioned here how the people, the conservatives and people on the right, and their inconsistency in their thinking about the way that people react with when they're an armed citizenry. But really, like I said a minute ago, inconsistency is really what statists, their whole philosophy is wrapped up in layers and layers of inconsistencies. You think about some of the things, now this is, I've written a list here of some of the things I've actually faced on the internet in debates with people where I was dealing with clearly right-wing or conservative individuals, and they would agree, oh, it's absolutely necessary that we cut government, that we restrict the power of government, that we cut the government waste and we cut government spending and lower taxes. And then in the same, practically, if you can have a breath on the internet when you're typing on a forum, in the same breath, they say, you know, what we need is we need to test the welfare recipients for drug use. So you want to cut government, shrink government, cut government spending, cut taxes, and then you want to create a giant bureaucracy of medical clinics all around the country and layers of bureaucrats testing and enforcing drug tests on welfare recipients. Do you have any concept about how much tax money that would absorb? Do you have any idea the levels of abuse that would eventually come out of that? And do you have any idea how easy it is to get a fake drug test around something like that? Do you realize that there are people who have been on probation, who have been on all kinds of different government-mandated programs where they had to be tested regularly and they still use drugs? Because there's always a way to get around the system if you want to. You realize that? Of course you don't, because you're inconsistent and you're a statist. Now, not all my listeners. I'm not accusing my listeners of being that. I'm just saying that this is what you face on when you're discussing these things on the internet or even in private life with people where you're one-on-one with a coworker or a family member. You see this kind of stuff all the time, this inconsistency. They want to cut government, but they want to crack down on crime. What? Yeah, we have to cut. We have to cut taxes, cut government, shrink government. But we need a bigger police force. We need more prisons. We need to expand what we call crime. We need to have more and more and more regulations saying this is against the law and that's against the law. And we need to go out there and round these people up. Have you thought about that? Have you really thought about this cracking down on crime? How about if you define what is crime? What are you calling crime? Because someone's doing something you don't approve of. That's crime? That's consistent. That's real consistent. We need to cut government. We need to cut government. We need to cut taxes. We need to shrink the government. And we need to build more nuclear submarines. We need more advanced fighter aircraft. And we need another aircraft carrier. Have you looked at the bill for one of those things? Who do we need more aircraft carriers to defend us from? Are we that paranoid? We already have the largest, most expensive military the world has ever known, spending more than almost all the other countries in the world combined. And you think we need a more advanced strike fighter? You think we need more aircraft carriers? We already have enough nuclear subs to kill every human being alive, and we need more? And you want to cut government and shrink government and cut taxes while you're doing this? Oh, but what we need is we need to stop being the police of the world. And we need to make sure that we protect Israel and South Korea. We need to stop being the police of the world. We need to stop being the puppets of the UN. And we need to protect Israel and South Korea. what? I don't even know how to answer that. Hey, did you think about that at all? Are you actually considering the words that are coming out of your mouth when you say these things? And let's not just pick on the right, because the left doesn't show the same level of complete illogical leaps like that, but they'll say things like, well, Bush was a warmonger and he should have been impeached and he should have been arrested for war crimes, and Obama's ending the wars. Really? In what alternate universe is Obama ending wars? Sending killer drone after killer drone after killer drone into a variety of countries that Bush wasn't even attacking, and Obama is just killing whoever he wants in whatever country he wants. We're now in more countries, our troops are now in more countries than they were under Bush. How is it that Obama is the peace candidate? How is he that he's the peace president? How do you believe such things that are so contrary to what is clearly evident? How do people on the left come to such twisted conclusions? Green energy is good so long as I don't see the pollution it makes or the devastation it causes. Yeah, we need to have more solar energy. We need to invest. We need to take more money in taxes and from American people, and we need to sink it into companies that are producing solar panels so that we can save the environment. Now, let's not think about for a moment where they get the minerals, those rare earth minerals that are taken out of small, weak African countries by Chinese, by aspects of the Chinese government, and they're hauled back to China, and the rivers that are polluted in China when they make your solar panels for you. Let's not think about that, and let's not think about the quantity of energy that's expended to get those minerals out of the ground, haul them from Africa to China, convert them into electric cells, and then ship them to the United States. Let's not think about any of that. Let's just feel good that we're saving the environment by putting up a solar panel on our house. Let's do that. That's the level of inconsistency we see from the left. Let's not think about at all. Let's not think about, oh, but I have an electric car, so I'm not polluting. Really? The electric just magically jumps out of the wall, right? The electricity didn't get to you from first burning coal, right? We're just going to ignore that entirely. We're going to ignore the fact that whenever you push electricity through wires, you lose a considerable amount of that electricity the further it pushes through the wires. We're not going to think about that, are we? We're not going to think about that. We're just going to assume that because you have an electric car, you're better. You're helping the environment. You're green. You bought something with the word green on it, therefore you feel good about yourself. That's the left. That's the inconsistency that the left provides for us. Sweatshops, we have to stop the sweatshops, even if it means that we're going to create vast poverty in the country that we stop the sweatshop. Even if it means that we're going to force young ladies and young boys into the only other alternatives in some of those countries is either begging and starving, digging through trash dumps to try to find food, or prostitution. But we can't have them in a sweatshop. So you can feel, you, Mr. Liberal, you can feel good about yourself because you were involved in shutting down a sweatshop in Indonesia. But you don't go back and find out what kind of devastation you did to the local economy when you shut that sweatshop down and put those people out of work. And you don't go back and look and see what they now have to do for a living. You don't want to think about that. You don't want to just sip your latte and ride in your crossover SUV and feel good about yourself. That's the inconsistency. That's what we get with statists, whether it's left or whether it's right, or whether it's libertarians pretending to be, whether it's left or rights pretending to be libertarians. It's the inconsistency that you face. And that's the thing that real libertarianism offers. consistency. The zero aggression principle and property rights is entirely consistent. And the more you embrace it, the more consistent you become, not only in your lives, but in your thinking and the clarity that begins to come into your mind. I've already run over a little bit, so let's just pause here and I'll bring in our commercial. I haven't got to record the new commercial yet, but I'll try to, I've been saying this for a week, I'll try to get the new commercial recorded so that we switch it up a little bit and it won't be boring. But anyway, here's a word, as they say in TV, a word from our sponsors. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page, and then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value, something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks, folks, for sitting through the commercial, and seriously, be sure and get over there and check out Survival Gear Bags and Shire Silver. They're great companies, great products, and some great folks. Now, getting back to my notes here, because I was kind of getting a little sweaty and a little angry and a little over the top. So, it's kind of nice now that I have that commercial break. It kind of lets me sort of get control of myself and not just go on and on and on. Okay, so here's some things to think about. When we're talking about consistency and people on the left and people on the right, now this is just a series of, let's just play some Socratic games here. Should people be treated differently due to the pigmentation of their skin? Should people be treated differently because of their family lineage? Because they come from a certain family, they're Habsburgs or they're Windsors, or are people different because of who their family has been, what their family name is? Should people be treated differently due to their family's wealth? If there were children in front of you, and you found out that one was hungry, and he was from the Bill Gates family, and another was hungry, and he was from the Joe Smith family, would you let the child of Joe Smith starve in order to feed the child of Bill Gates? Or should people be treated the same, no matter who their family is, and how wealthy their family is? Should people be treated differently because of who their employer is? So, for example, if one person is employed as a trash truck driver and the other person is employed as a banker, should the trash truck driver be treated differently simply because his employer has him drive a trash truck? Should the banker be treated as a better person because he's a banker? Or, you know, the other side of that, we think of bankers generally nowadays, we think of bankers in a pretty negative note. So there are two people in front of you. One is a known banker, criminal that he is, and the other drives a trash truck. Do we think that the person who drives the trash, do we just naturally think that the person who drives the trash truck is a better human being and more important than the dirty banker? Or do we realize that people are the same? They may make different decisions, they may have different educations, they may come from different walks of life, they may have different beliefs, but really people are the same. Do we believe that? Or do we believe that some people have more rights than others, or different rights than others? Like some people have the right to say certain things, but other people don't have the right to say certain things? Do we consistently approach all of these questions, or do we adjust these questions for what we like to? Are we like that person on the left who doesn't want to think about where the green energy is coming from, or doesn't want to think about the fact that in order to get that that green biofuel, that you have to devastate land with petrochemicals in order to grow the crops in overproduction, monocropping, in order to get the level of corn production that you have to have to produce your green fuel? You don't want to think about that, see? Well, it's the same thing with these other questions about human beings. Do you really want to face these questions and think about it? Is the pigmentation of a person's skin a reason to treat them differently, or because of their family lineage, or their heritage, the family's wealth, or who their employer is? Do we really believe that some people have different rights than other people have because of some of these classifications? Then why is it that we believe that if a person is employed by the state, that they can behave in a way differently than a person who's employed by anybody else? Why is it we believe that when a person is employed by the state, that they can suddenly make laws for the rest of us? That they can judge the rest of us? That they can enforce laws upon the rest of us? That they can capture, arrest, imprison, and punish us because their employer happens to be the state? Are we consistent in this? And then we tell ourselves, well, it's different. See, it's different with the state because you get to vote. You get to vote on who's in government. So if you can vote on who's in government, then that justifies the violence of the state. That justifies the aggression that the state authorizes, as long as you have a say in government. Well, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I've done it several times on the podcast. If I can remember, I'll put a link in the show notes for today to a thing called The Tale of the Slave by Robert Nozack. And there's a version of it on YouTube that's read by Tom Woods. It's really good. And if I can remember, I'll put a link on badquaker.com on the page that this podcast appears. And you can follow that link over to YouTube. And it's short. I don't think, I don't know, it might be 6 or 7 minutes, something like that. It's not very long at all. And it's Tom Woods just reading The Tale of the Slave by Robert Nozack. And if you really think that the state gives the authority for people to behave differently simply because we can vote and we have a say in government, then honestly, go click that link, go over to YouTube, watch the video. They have some animation and some pictures and so forth, but basically it's Tom Woods reading The Tale of the Slave by Robert Nozick. So then now it comes to laws. So we've got these people making up laws, and they make up laws as they see fit. And, you know, I was watching, it's the Guns and Weed movie that the Freedom Fiends over there did, that Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati did. And I was watching that, and they made a great statement in that movie. They were talking about, there's one section in the movie where they're talking about how they're comparing gun laws and marijuana laws in the different states within the United States. And they're telling how the law is this way in Alaska, and the law is this way in Montana, and the way is this way in Colorado. And in some places, if you're caught with marijuana, no big deal. In the same place, you're caught with a gun, you're in serious trouble. In another place, you can have that gun, but you'd better not have marijuana. And in another place, and these are all changing from city to city, from state to state. In some states, possessing a gun is a serious crime. It doesn't matter the right wingers love to pound their chest and talk about the Second Amendment. Folks, the Second Amendment doesn't mean squat. Read it for yourself. That thing has been entirely rendered useless. It says in it, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Infringed. Do you know what fringe is? If you take a look at a tablecloth and that little part that goes around the bottom with the little threads that hang down, that's the fringe. To infringe means to touch the edge. If I have property, if I have a square lot of property that's 100 feet long and 100 feet wide, to infringe upon my property means to touch the edge of it. It does not mean to drive a tractor truck into the middle of it. That's not infringe. To infringe is when your toe touches my property. That's to infringe. To infringe is when your arm reaches out over top of my property and you've infringed my property even though you didn't touch the dirt underneath it. That's infringe. Well, folks, the Second Amendment means nothing because it says that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. They've infringed, and people are doing nothing about it. And somebody hears that and they say, oh no, people are doing a lot about it. People are working within the system. And how's that been going for you? How's that been going for you? Do you really think you're winning? Let's go back to how ridiculously the left looks at things when they talk about green energy and all their nonsense like that, where they justify their behavior by thinking they feel good about what they're doing. Well, isn't that what the right wing does? Isn't that what conservatives do when they cling to the Second Amendment while they watch it dissolve? When they say, oh, well, we know that the government will keep in line because we still have the Second Amendment. And in the meantime, their mothers and their sisters and their daughters and their wives are being molested by the TSA on a consistent basis. And they step back and they do nothing because we've still got our guns. We've got our Second Amendment. It doesn't matter that they're molesting your wife and your children. It doesn't matter that you're throwing away all of your rights. As long as you can cling to that myth that there's a Second Amendment and that you can still, that you still have your supposed gun rights. Well, there are no gun rights. There are only property rights. In nowhere in nature are we born with a gun or do we have a gun. I'm born with arms. I'm born with a nose. I'm born with my body and with myself. So I have a right to own myself. And I'm born with the ability to produce, the ability to work. And therefore, the product of my work, my labor, I own. And then we continue with understanding property rights as I'm not going to go through all the stages of property, but as you go through that, you consistently understand that you have a right based on property. But you have no more right to a gun. There's a lot of, on the internet, there's a lot of mockery being made of some stupid liberal woman who came out and as a stooge of the Obama administration. wanting birth control, wanting free birth control. And she made this argument that she deserves free birth control. And there's a lot of mockery of her on the internet with pictures saying, you know, that if logically speaking, if she feels that she deserves free birth control from the Obama administration, then why shouldn't she have this free and why shouldn't she have that free? But it's the same flaw that the right winger, that the conservative falls into. If you have a right to a gun, see, you have a right to your life. You have a right to own the things, the fruit of your labor. Well, this is simply an understanding of property rights. But you don't have a right to a gun. Nobody has to provide you with a gun any more than somebody has to provide you with bubble gum or birth control. You don't have a right to a gun, and she doesn't have a right to birth control. You have a right to life, to your life, and you have no right to infringe upon anybody else. Infringe. Infringe. I'm about to run out of time, and I didn't even get to, I've been ranting and ranting about all these other things, and I didn't really get to what I wanted to talk about. Well, isn't that about typical? Okay, so let's get to it then. We being all of us, but specifically those of us that are libertarians or in the libertarian or in the liberty movement, liberty activists, the anarchists, the minarchists, all of those of us who strive and desire for a freer world and for more liberty. All of us, we are about to see something. We're about to see something that I haven't seen in my lifetime, and I would dare to say it's been generations since this has happened. Although Murray Rothbard contradicts what I just said, because he saw this happen and described it, but what we're about to see causes Murray's description to pale. And so I'm gonna read what Murray Rothbard wrote in 1983. This is Murray Rothbard from 1983. The libertarian movement has experienced all the syndromes of an Austrian business cycle in the real world. A massive and sudden infusion of funds in 1977 through 1980 led to an artificial lengthening of the structure of production, an overinvestment in new and expanded institutions. Unknown nerds were plucked from obscurity, vaulted into positions of prominence and power, and given hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars to play with. After the hubris came the inevitable disillusion and drastic contraction, with the attendant painful liquidation of people and institutions that we see in every panic depression phase of the cycle. That liquidation is now taking place, unfortunately dragging many estimable people and organizations down with it. So now what Murray was referring to there actually took place in the early 80s. He didn't name them, but he was talking specifically about the Koch brothers and money that came from the Koch family. But not only them, there was others as well. But there was this sudden infusion of wealth into the liberty movement between 1977 and 1980. And I might say that's when I first became involved in the liberty movement in 1979. And there was this giant influx of attention and funding and intellectual thought and activity and membership, and all these things took place. And it was an artificial boom. And by 1983, when Murray Rothbard wrote what I just read, he was seeing the beginning of the popping of that bubble. He began to see the latter stages of that business cycle taking place within the liberty movement. Now, what Murray could not predict, and what Murray had no idea, would eventually come to be is a bubble, a cycle, so to speak, an Austrian cycle or a bubble far greater than Murray could have ever imagined. And its name is Ron Paul. Now, I've said this a lot of times. I really like Ron Paul. I like everything he has to say. Well, almost everything he has to say. I first voted for Ron Paul in 1988. There's a lot of great stuff I could say about the Ron Paul message and the Ron Paul movement and everything else. But what we, all of us together, all of us in the Liberty Movement need to realize is that we are in the midst of a bubble, a Ron Paul bubble. And we're going to see some things happening in the next 12 months. And we need to prepare for them. And we need to not only prepare ourselves mentally and prepare ourselves financially, but we also need to prepare those around us so that when this happens, they're not so stunned by it that they're thrown out of the Liberty Movement completely. Because a lot of people are really going to be disillusioned. And so we really need to prepare them for this. Now, honestly, folks, Ron Paul, no matter how much you love him, no matter how much money you send to his campaign, no matter how much effort you put into trying to get him nominated as the Republican nominee and eventually elected as president, Ron Paul is not going to be the Republican candidate for president. The party will not allow that to happen. I've said this over and over. They will cheat. They will lie. They will steal. They will fake elections. They will do whatever they have to do. And if under some freak circumstances Ron Paul could actually get the nomination, they'll kill him. They will. They will do that. Those people will do that. They've done it before. They'll do it again. So Ron Paul is not going to go to the general election in 2012 under a major party ticket. He's not going to do it. Ron Paul is doing a great work in opening people's eyes and bringing them towards the concepts of liberty. But Ron Paul is not going to win the Republican nomination. And when this happens, and when he doesn't win, here is what will happen. The state will provide a substitute, a false Ron Paul. The state always does this. They will provide us with a false Ron Paul. And I'm not talking about a Newt Romney, a Mitt Romney or a Newt Gingrich. Those are not false Ron Pauls. A false Ron Paul is somebody who's going to seem like they embrace liberty. I'll tell you who's a false Ron Paul. Not anymore. But when they first appeared on the public scene, Sarah Palin was a false Ron Paul when she first appeared on the public scene. In every way, the Liberty people embraced her because they thought she didn't say much, but what she did say was very appealing to them. So they embraced her at first, and it took a while for some people to really get past that facade and really see what she was down deep inside. And I'm telling you, you mark my words, the Republican Party will provide a false Ron Paul. And Ron Paul will lose, and a lot of people will be disillusioned. And I'll even say Barack Obama is going to get reelected. And a lot of people are going to be crushed over this. And the Ron Paul movement will teeter. It won't dissolve entirely, because there are very dedicated people who believe in this, all of this stuff that we're talking about. There are lots of dedicated people that believe it, even if there was no Ron Paul. Even if Ron Paul magically disappeared tomorrow, there's a lot of us who would still hold with all these concepts and all these principles. So we're not just disappearing, but the money is going to dry up very rapidly in 2013. A lot of activity that you see in the Liberty Movement is going to vanish. It's a lot of people who've poured their soul into helping Ron Paul are going to be disillusioned. And it's up to all of us to reach out to those people and not let them fall back into the left-right myth of government. It's going to be up to all of us to be able to hold the line at a time like that, when it happens in 2013, and hold things together. And let's see what comes out of this when we come into the next phase of whatever the Liberty Movement is going to be. I'm excited about it. I know that all bubbles have to pop, and I'm excited to see what comes next. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks.